This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
We present quantitative evidence suggesting that the persistence of an environment suitable for life, for any appreciable period of time, is only possible as long as a substantial area of the planet's surface is occupied by natural ecosystems, undisturbed by anthropogenic activities. Once the natural biotic mechanism of environmental control is destroyed, both local and global environment rapidly degrade to a state unfit for life, even if any direct anthropogenic environmental impact like industrial pollution is absent. That short summary contains a world of meaning. The authors are Viktor G. Gorshkov and Anastasia Makareva. Both are from the Theoretical Physics Division of the Petersburg Nuclear Physics Institute in St. Petersburg, Russia. The pair have issued a number of papers that have stirred global discussion. Our next interview comes from a scientist and theorist who shakes things up. I expect to learn from her. No doubt you and I will not agree with everything she says. I will save my comments until after the interview.
Radio EcoShock.
Our guest, Anastasia Makareva, received her PhD in mathematics and physics, including atmospheric physics, from St. Petersburg State University. She's now a senior researcher in the physical and biological basis of life stability. From St. Petersburg, Russia, Anastasia, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hello.
It's a pleasure to have this chance for discussion. Why don't we start with that powerful quote from your 2004 paper with Viktor? You present the idea that our life-sustaining environment depends on large parts of the planet operating without our interference. Many think that is true, but how could you prove that scientifically?
Well, to prove this, we need to actually to do a multidisciplinary research because it is a view on life as a program. You see, we all know that life makes an impact on the environment where it exists. But this environment is not physically stable. For example, if we look at climate, we have many destabilizing positive feedbacks, one of which is the feedback, the role of water vapor and its impact on temperature. So we cannot explain from physical grounds why our climate is stabilized at the global mean temperature that we observe at around 14 degrees Celsius. And when we study these mechanisms of climate stability, we came to the conclusion that the only mechanism that could impose a stabilizing impact is a mechanism of biotic nature. So it is life itself.
Well, let's follow up on your idea. Suppose our civilization managed to clean up industrial pollution and humans expand, but with clean technology. Even then, you say, if we go too far into those lands where nature operates, we will lose a planet fit to live on. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, yes. This is what we are saying. And you see, this is the idea, the main idea. If the environment is not stable by itself, but it is stabilized by the biota, by natural ecosystems, then if we remove the stabilizing impact, then we can no longer enjoy stability of climate and environment.
Well, one final point from that 2004 paper, you claim that the acute threats we face today justify rethinking, quote, the foundations of ecological science. So do you think science is working or is it failing us in some ways?
I think that the dominant view on the biosphere is not correct. The idea that life regulates the environment and makes it stable was proposed by Lovelock. And biotic regulation, which we develop, my co-author Viktor Gorshkov, he developed it independently, but this idea was proposed by Lovelock. And he was criticized. And he he had the same arguments, the same ideas that without a stabilizing impact, the environment is not stable. But he was criticized on the grounds that this regulation of the environment by the biota cannot be sustained by natural selection, because there will certainly appear a cheater, some organism which will not regulate the environment but will benefit from the regulation by other organisms, and finally they will outcompete all these good regulating biota, and so any regulation by the biota is unstable in the long run as evolution proceeds with these cheaters. Do you understand me?
Yes, but we may be the cheaters.
Yes, yes, yes. But this discussion about the role of the biosphere ended at this point. So many biologists and ecologists cannot accept the existence of this regulation because of these arguments put forward by neo-Darwinists. But as we as physicists and theoreticians, we are concerned about quantitative estimates. And when we looked at this debate, no one has estimated the probability that such a cheater will appear. Because those who supported biotic regulation, they said to the neo-Darwinists, and how can you explain that the environment has remained suitable for life through all these nearly 4 billion years of life existence? Our society is now becomes more and more information-oriented. People begin to realize that actually biological systems are also information systems. And for example, in biology, there is now an active discussion where death is programmed and aging, whether they are programmed. Because if there is a program of death of an organism, then we can find it, for example, in humans, switch it off and live much longer. So I want to emphasize that it is very important to decipher what genetic information which contains in the genomes of species which compose natural ecosystem, what does this genetic information carry? Does it carry a program of environmental regulation, or it doesn't? Because if it does, we could use it for our benefits. And if it does, if we destroy natural ecosystems, it won't function for our benefits. And we will have problems which we cannot even anticipate because we don't know what and how this program is working. And I want to give you an example that it is not just an academic problem which can interest only theorists. You know the problem of the missing sink in the global carbon budget. It is a problem of direct relevance to the global warming, to the carbon emissions, and et cetera, et cetera. The problem is, and it was formulated a few decades ago, that when it was clear that carbon is accumulating, CO2 is accumulating in the atmosphere, people saw that not all that we emit via fossil fuel burning, not all this carbon actually accumulates in the atmosphere. Something is missing. People soon realized that a certain part is absorbed by the ocean, because ocean came out of the physico-chemical equilibrium which it was in during the pre-industrial era. So as it was returning to this equilibrium, it absorbed some carbon. But it was not enough. So, for example, say we know how much we burnt, how much fossil fuel we burnt, how much CO2 is emitted. We knew how much is accumulating in the atmosphere thanks to the works of Keeling and others. And we knew, using measurements in the ocean, how much of the ocean absorbs, but still there was no match. So the budget, we couldn't close the budget. And then, because it was already known that the biosphere is an active player, you see, there are, by the order of magnitude, about 1,000 gigatons of CO2 carbon, but the same amount of carbon in organic form is stored in the terrestrial biota. There is also, excluding soil, there is also soil biota. And also, we knew that there are very active processes of synthesis and decomposition at around 100 gigatons a year. So those geophysicists who knew only this about the biota, they began to think, oh, there must be something with the biota. And from our point of view, from the biotic regulation point of view, and we wrote it in our papers on this topic at that time, of course, the biota, if it had the program of environmental regulation, it must have been reacting to this pollution and taking this excessive polluting carbon from the atmosphere. So undisturbed biota, where this program is in action, must have been doing just that. And it is a very complex problem. We don't know how it works. So, for example, if you cut a finger, you don't know in detail how your organism heals this problem. But you do know that it maintains the homeostasis and something will be done and ultimately the skin will regenerate. So from this general principle, we could predict that the biota will react. Meanwhile, traditional ecology is dominated by the view that functioning of the biota is limited by biogens that are present in the smallest relative quantities. Or in simple words, it is limited by nitrogen or phosphorus. And since this nitrogen, as we all know, those people who grow something in their gardens know that we must put fertilizers to improve productivity. And so they said that since the nitrogen was not growing, only carbon, so many ecologists said that they didn't believe that the biosphere could be a global sink of carbon. And so this missing sink has been present in the literature for decades. And only when they were faced with direct measurements showing that the biota, indeed, the trees indeed improved, increased productivity and started taking more carbon from the atmosphere, only then the most recent papers mentioning this program are dated by this decade. So it is a recent issue still mentioning missing things. So only then this mechanism was accepted. And why? Because they could ultimately measure this effect. Literally, people across the world went to the forest, measured trees, and tried to then extrapolate this to the globe as a whole. But as they still felt that it is a sink, which is not very, they were not very comfortable that it exists. So they, in their other estimates of the carbon budget, they reduced the other sources such that to make this sink as small as possible. And for example, carbon emissions from land use change, they become smaller. Currently, in the carbon budget, land use changes, so how much carbon is emitted by soil erosion and things like this, have the highest relative uncertainty. And since people want to make this missing sink, this uncomfortable thing, smaller, this means that the land use source is also made smaller within the uncertainty ranges. And so actually, it can well be that our disturbance of the atmosphere with land use is much larger than we currently think.
This is Radio EcoShock. Light up your iPod or computer with tons of free green audio from our website at www.ecoshock.org. That's E-C-O, shock like an electric shock, .org.
You are tuned to the one and only Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest, scientist Anastasia Makareva from the Petersburg Nuclear Physics Institute in Russia. Now, following up almost exactly from what you've just said, we have new science from the Woods Hole Research Center just coming out about the role of tropical forests as now a source of carbon. They find that about 69% of carbon loss from those forests comes not from direct deforestation like logging, but from simple degradation and disturbance by humans And that reminds me exactly of your 2004 paper about human free spaces and what you've just been talking about.
Yes, exactly. And one thing that people rarely mention, how the reaction, a stabilizing reaction of the biota to disturbance, is necessarily a reaction of the community as a whole. So it is not trees that remove pollution, that remove excessive carbon. It is the whole community, because what does it mean to remove carbon? It means that the biota must store it in some inactive form within the ecosystem. So it must synthesize some inactive organic substance and store it. Only in this, owing to the metaconservation, it is the only way to remove carbon. And imagine that you are, say, a bacterium sitting in soil and suddenly finding that there is more organic matter synthesized, and you live on this, on eating this, actually. But in order to ensure a stabilizing response, this bacterium must ignore this excessive organic matter and allow it to accumulate. So the whole community of autotrophs and heterotrophs must act in cooperation, and only in this case there will be a net reaction, a net stabilizing reaction. But now, modern science views it in very simplistic form, like trees are being fertilized by carbon. Now they are forced to accept it. But in fact, it is not trees that are doing it. It is the whole community that reacts in a coordinated manner. And since all organisms act based on their genetic information, based on their genomes, what is written in them, so it is a realization of this genetic program of environmental stabilization. So actually, we spent a lot of time studying the carbon cycle and not knowing in detail how the biota works, still studying the cycle, it is possible to calculate the strength of this stabilizing feedback. And then we can calculate how much of natural biota globally we need such that it fully stops accumulation of carbon in the atmosphere, even if we don't stop emitting carbon and still continue with fossil fuels and so on. So this is just an example that relying on this mechanism that is already functioning, if we study it, if we quantify it, we could rely on it such and make it work for us and solve our environmental problems.
Now, our recent Radio EcoShock guest, Dr. Douglas Scheel from the Norwegian University of Life Sciences, he works to study and preserve tropical forests, and he cited your work in something called a biotic pump. Can you briefly tell us what is a biotic pump?
Yes. Besides carbon, water is, of course, a major substance of importance for life. So a general prediction of the biotic regulation concept would be that natural ecosystems must be able to regulate and sustain and maintain in optimal conditions their water regime. And so we have been always interested in this topic, but when in 2005 we got a new friend, a new colleague from Brazil, Antonio Nobre, and he provides us a lot of information on the Amazon rainforest and the hydrological cycle. And then we realized that there is a very peculiar pattern observed in all forested river basins in the world. But in contrast to unforested areas, where precipitation rapidly declines with distance from the ocean, in forested regions of the world, including the Siberia, the Russian boreal forest region, the Amazon, Congo, and partially Canada, precipitation remains nearly constant or even grows with distance from the ocean. And since a certain part of precipitation goes to the river runoff, and so is lost, it looked like something is pumping this water, and the only way water can come to deep inland is from the ocean. So it looked like the forest was pumping the moisture from the atmosphere. And we began to think, what could the physical mechanism of this biotically mediated moisture transport be? And then, using some previous results we obtained in 2002 about the non-equilibrium distribution of water vapor in the atmosphere, we realized that since moist atmosphere is unstable to condensation, if the forests keep the atmosphere moistened, then they will initiate condensation and the rising air motion over the forest. And this rising air motion will facilitate drawing moisture in the lower atmosphere from the ocean deep inland. And this fact that precipitation at a given latitude does not decline with distance from the ocean, this is indicative of a controlling influence the forest imposes on this process of moisture transport.
Can I assume that those forests doing the transporting have to remain more or less as a chain from the ocean to the inland, and that if we cut off an intervening forest, would that change the rainfall further inland?
Yes, exactly, exactly. And as we wrote already in our first paper on the topic, this provides an explanation for the partially mysterious disappearance of vegetation cover in Australia, which approximately, very approximately coincides with large uncertainty with the arrival of humans. And here the mechanism could be that humans who settled on the oceanic coast doing fishing and so on, they destroyed, probably by fires, the coastal belt of vegetation, and thus they cut off the biotic pump of the inner forest from its source of moisture. And then this inland forest would perish, and this ecological catastrophe would have left no measurable trace, so it would be just instantaneous. And this could explain why so little evidence can be collected about this abrupt transition. And also, recent research shows that humans similarly might have contributed to the desertification of Sahara, which occurred several thousand years ago. Of course, we don't exclude geophysical factors, which are always at play. But in the presence of geophysical factors, humans can contribute to the local vegetation being unable to withstand these unfavorable geophysical factors and switches. So, for example, in the subtropical regions where there is, at the border of the Hadley and Ferrel cells, where there is this massive descending motion of air which suppresses condensation and makes everything drier. So these regions are particularly vulnerable to disturbances in vegetation. And so nature might have been able to cope with these problems and to establish in these difficult regions, but it was difficult for the ecosystem. And when humans came to these vulnerable regions, they contributed to some unfavorable geophysical processes like whatever they could be, switch of oceanic circulation, large scale or something. And these fragile ecosystems, which could have lived as they were without humans, they perished. And desertification followed and it appeared irreversible. So it cannot now switch back to a more moistened regime.
Okay, now I want to say that listeners can find a good description of the biotic pump theory and bioregulation at the website www.bioticregulation.ru, and you can find that also in English. And I'll put links to all the science we're talking about in my show blog at ecoshock.org.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. My guest is scientist Anastasia Makareva from St. Petersburg, Russia. Now, your work has been published in some of the top scientific journals, including the Proceedings of the Royal Society and in Physics Letters. Yet, your 2008 paper on hurricanes was eventually rejected by Atmospheric Chemistry Physics, the open access journal of the European Geosciences Union. What were you saying about hurricanes, and does that tell us anything about the huge, devastating hurricanes we've just seen sweeping the Caribbean, Florida, and Texas?
You see, indeed, this paper in 2008 was rejected, and as I was younger that time, it was actually a very painful event for us. But later we published the same things in other journals. But the matter is that since we are theorists, we seek quantitative estimates. And when we propose that the biotic pump depends on the intensity of condensation, we naturally wanted to perform a self-check. Because without a biotic pump, there is a lot of condensation which occurs over the ocean. And the most spectacular processes involving condensation are hurricanes. So we asked ourselves, if we are right in that condensation over forest draws these mild, moist winds towards the forest, we must be able to describe the generation of kinetic energy of hurricane winds on the same basis. And to show that here too, the hurricane intensity is proportional to condensation rate. And that is what we tried to do and actually accomplished, I think, quite well. So we consider it to be our success, and we are very fond of this research of hurricanes. And we confirmed our prediction that indeed, and showed that indeed, hurricane intensity is proportional to condensation rate, exactly as we predicted in our theoretical framework. But in terms of implications, it means that actually hurricanes and forests compete for atmospheric moisture. If there is a big forest which draws oceanic moisture inland to feed rivers and life and all life on land, then hurricanes will have less moisture and there will be a lower probability of hurricanes to develop. You see, this is the main practical conclusion. And conversely, if we destroy forests and destroy this moisture transport of water vapor from over the ocean to land, then there is more moisture remaining over the oceans, and hurricanes can have plenty of food, and they can have a greater probability of developing and becoming more intense.
All right. Now, you went even further to suggest a new theory of wind, and that also brought some scientific criticism. Can you tell us about that theory?
Actually, this is not a new theory of winds, but we just see that condensation plays a major role in generating winds. You see, this is a very long-standing problem in atmospheric sciences. It was formulated already by Lorentz in 1960s or even earlier, that we must understand why the atmospheric power has the observed value. What does it mean? We know that wind energy dissipates. You see, it is not eternal. Winds are generated by pressure gradients and dissipate into smaller eddies and ultimately to heat. So this process of dissipation of wind energy is counteracted by generation of wind energy, and this generation is known to be about 1% of the order of 1% of the incoming solar energy. And so Lorentz asked and posed this problem that we must understand why it is so, why it is 1%, why it is not a hundredth of percent, or why it is not 10%, and what determines this figure. And since then, there was no answer given to this question from the atmospheric theory. You see, because global circulation models, in global circulation models, you can model any desirable atmospheric power by tuning friction. So global circulation models are just fitted to produce the same, the observed power. And there are no theoretical expressions which will explain why this power has the observed magnitude. And when we propose that actually it is condensation that is responsible for generation of winds, we showed that the predicted expression, which we predict for this power using the observed precipitation rates, which are more or less well known, we obtain a figure that agrees satisfactorily with independent observations. And this result is often misinterpreted because people are saying that we deny all other mechanisms of wind formation, that we, I don't know what. No, we don't deny anything, any well-established physics about the atmosphere. We're a very strong, in our opinion, piece of evidence which suggests that it is condensation and the non-equilibrium distribution of water vapor in the gravitational field of Earth, and that this property of our atmosphere is responsible for the fact that wind generation, the generation of wind power on Earth, is proportional to condensation and precipitation. That's our main result.
Anastasia, what is your position on climate change?
My position on climate change is that humans have contributed enormously to devastating the biosphere. If we look from, say, from 1860 to 2005, the degree of anthropogenic disturbance of the biosphere has grown from 4% of land to about 30%. And we know that vegetation is responsible for evaporation on land and that this process captures about half of solar radiation, latent heat. And so if you imagine that you disturb vegetation, which on such a big area, 30%, and that you disturb this process of evaporation, which is about 80 watts per square meters, this could provide very significant changes to radiation balance of the Earth, which is comparable to radiative forcing, which is now said to be warming the Earth. So this process, in our view, has contributed, the process of destroying natural vegetation has contributed to those climatic changes that we are now observing.
But you haven't mentioned fossil fuels. You've made a biological explanation for climate change. Do you include fossil fuels as a powerful force as well?
The matter is that as I haven't done global circulation modeling, unlike other people, I cannot tell you that I am convinced in those numerical estimates of the effects of carbon on, and that carbon is fossil fuel emissions are as responsible for the observed climate change as, say, I don't know, IPCC is saying or something. Moreover, recent publications, which I don't very much follow because now we are doing other things, but specifically for this talk, I looked through some publications and it appears that this uncertainty is becoming to be recognized in the mainstream media. Like the recent publication in the Bulletin of American Meteorological Society, something like the science and art of model tuning or something. This idea is that rather than stemming directly from physics, from physical constraints, this climate sensitivity to CO2 can be to a large degree tuned within an anticipated range. You know, in Russia there is a very special situation. What is very special situation when all ecologists who were saying something against industrial expansion were termed like something like deniers of the national good. So I am very sensible to this idea that everyone who says something against this carbon topic is immediately in the American press labeled as a denier. But you should understand that this uncertainty, given this uncertainty, placing so much emphasis on carbon is dangerous because it is overlooking probably more important drivers of climate change. For example, as a scientist who is convinced that the biota, the role of the biota, is drastically underestimated, I cannot remain emotionally neutral to such ideas like, for example, the spread of biofuel. The advancement of biofuel, which is said to be carbon neutral, goes exactly against what I as a scientist hold, because if we are concerned only about fossil fuel emissions, then we can actually deforest land and grow biofuel on these territories, and it's okay. But if the biosphere keeps our climate suitable for us, it will be a suicide, a crime against humanity. You see, so while IPCC, for many environmental activists, definitely for regreening and things like that, all green things. In fact, this emphasis on carbon is, from the point of view of the biota, it is close to a crime, because biofuel expansion is a recognized driver of deforestation. So how can we, knowing increasingly that these carbon estimates are so uncertain, to base such policies on that, destroying policies? And another thing, a very important one, clouds are a major component of uncertainty. Clouds. Now, based on the same models which say that carbon is the main component of global warming, the same models promote the statement that actually deforestation and desertification is good because the albedo becomes higher and so more sunlight is reflected and so the earth becomes cooler. It is also such an irresponsible, just irresponsible papers. The last one I read appeared in Climate Dynamics, a Canadian journal, a mainstream one. Huge uncertainties. They add up negative and positive values of similar magnitude such, and play on the resulting net number, which is highly uncertain. And they publish such things. Then I recently talked to a woman who was fighting for 20 years to protect the Great Barrier Rainforest in British Columbia. And I recently wrote to her, as well as other colleagues, that if these foresters had this paper in their hands, they could not have reached an agreement which now protects a large part of this forest against deforestation. Those people said, oh, you see, we deforest everything, we make a desert, and we are okay, we are helping our planet not to die from warming.
Wow.
So now what? Do you and Gorshkov spend your time further proving your large body of work, or do you have new citadels of science to question? Do you have new research in the works or awaiting publication?
Oh, yes, of course we are continuously working. We have a very large program, and you see that this biotic regulation is a multidisciplinary concept, so we need to have some expertise in all fields. Because one problem why this biotic regulation, as our readers sometimes ask us, why is not your biotic regulation known more widely? And we are saying because it requires to be appreciated, it requires the person has knowledge of problems in many disciplines. Meanwhile, modern science is very compartmentalized. For example, all climate science is dominated by people, and historically was dominated by people, probably less so recently, who don't know anything about the biota. They knew nothing. These were technical folks who wrote and programmed their equations, and that's it. So, but the biotic regulation requires a synthesis of knowledge from fields as diverse as genetics and climatology. And it is not a philosophical construction, but in every field we are trying to come forward with quantitative estimates demonstrating the strength of the effects we are describing.
Well, we have just a couple of minutes left. Is there anything else you would like to tell our listeners?
I don't know. I myself spend a lot of time in natural forests and near the sea, and because it is very important for a theorist not just to write some formula, but also have these intrinsic measurements when you see, when you hear. And I want just to say that when we discovered the biotic pump, it was a very high spirited, very deep emotion of like your eyes opened and we understood what trees are actually doing. So it is not a scientific thing, but now we feel even more tremendous respect for trees because it is really magnificent organisms created by nature. And they are able to drive these global scale processes like moisture transport and keeping this moisture in soil and initiating condensation, which is needed. So these are really, they are like gods. And so when you look at the tree, just think of it.
We have been speaking with Dr. Anastasia Makareva from the Petersburg Nuclear Physics Institute in St. Petersburg, Russia. Please explore the website at bioticregulation.ru. Or you can look for links to the half dozen papers and articles we've talked about in my weekly show blog published every Wednesday at ecoshock.org. Anastasia, it's been a real treat talking with you. Thank you.
Thank you for your interest.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
Before you get that nasty email ready, yes, I did hear Anastasia describe global warming as a biological phenomenon caused by humans. She dodged the role of fossil fuel emissions, which most scientists on this program cite as the leading driver of climate change. Let's break this problem up into two parts. First, Dr. Makareva is a state-funded scientist in Russia, a country whose largest single exports are oil and gas. Although nominally a democracy, the Kremlin discourages climate activism and may remove academics who, as they see it, threaten the national interest. We could say it is in the interests of the current government to dismiss criticism of fossil fuels and to sow doubt about the real causes of climate change. But who are we talking about, Russia or the Trump administration, which is dismantling climate science and appointing deniers to key posts? The current government of Australia is not much better. Canada is just emerging from 10 years of muzzling climate scientists. There are scientists in many countries who cannot say all they would. The second part is more subtle and, I think, more important. As you heard in this interview, Anastasia Makareva is passionate about forests and the living world. She sees the important role of biology in controlling climate being lost in the noise about fossil fuels only. Makareva is not alone in that. I hear fairly regularly from forest campaigners who see vast areas being lost, whether it's in the boreal or in Brazil. They just had huge losses in Brazil again. But to get funding, these forest campaigners have to stress the carbon role, the climate angle. We could expand that to anti-nuclear campaigners and activists who are fighting off bee-killing pesticides or other poisonous wastes. It's fair to say that the general destruction of the planet can at times get lost in our fixation on the singular doom of climate change and fossil fuels. Even so, The vast majority of the world's scientists do say the most immediate threat to a livable climate comes from human-induced climate emissions and from fossil fuel burning in particular. If we carry on with the carbon economy as it is, you know and I know that civilization as we know it may not survive. I will have more to say about this interview with Dr. Makariva in my weekly show blog, published every Wednesday at ecoshock.org. I appreciate her joining us on Radio EcoShock. Just a couple of years ago, the climate solutions we heard from pundits and governments was mostly about industrial solutions to industrial pollution. How times have changed. A new paper coming out in the prestigious Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences outlines 20 steps we can take to work with nature instead. The effort was led by the Nature Conservancy, with 32 authors from a slew of universities and countries. If we are going to have a habitable future, this may be it. Lewis Bloomberg is the director of the California Climate Change Program of the Nature Conservancy's California chapter. He has a long history in climate solutions while working for the EPA and the state of California. Lewis, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex. It's a pleasure to be here, and thank you for the invitation.
Well, I appreciate you showing up. I want to bring you up to speed here. As listeners know, we've heard Anne-Marie Eldering of NASA and Alessandro Baccini from Woods Hole tell us that the tropics have flipped from being a carbon sink to becoming a carbon source. Climate change threatens to make this the new normal. Lewis, did your team find ways to turn this around?
Well, our new paper that was released this week confirms that natural climate solutions are an important and essential tool in the effort to combat climate change. We're using the latest analysis showing that improvements in how we manage our forests, farms, ranches, and wetlands can generate significant benefits to the atmosphere. Ultimately, 37% of the emission reductions that are needed to keep warming below 2 degrees centigrade.
Now, protecting natural lands is the mission of the Nature Conservancy. I wonder, when did your organization realize they were becoming climate fighters as well?
Well, Alex, I've been with the Nature Conservancy 14 years, and so that started before my time. I've been working on the role of nature and climate since 2000, but the Nature Conservancy started somewhere around 1991 or two, as far as I know, looking at efforts to stop tropical deforestation.
To get to this paper, we've already been misled by things like clean coal, carbon credits, carbon offsets. Why should we not be suspicious of this new label, natural climate solutions?
Well, Alex, we are not suspicious of forest carbon offsets. In fact, in California, they're working really well. And there's a long history that the Nature Conservancy has working with the state of California to make these real, dependable, reliable emission reductions. So that said, I think with natural climate solutions, this is just the next step, if you will, moving beyond forest offsets. This is looking at how we manage our forests, farms, ranches, and wetlands. We know that we can do better and at the same time generate benefits to the atmosphere while managing these lands better.
Could you please give us in detail two examples of natural climate solutions?
Well, I guess a couple of examples. So I would start with the Garcia River Forest in Mendocino County, which is 24,000 acres, about 14,000 hectares. That's a property that we worked with the partner called the Conservation Fund to purchase in 2002. And in 2004, we set up the first forest carbon offset project there on that property. So this is a what we call natural forest management. So this is land that was redwood forest that was heavily cut over, and we, with the Conservation Fund, have implemented a sustainable logging plan that's generating significant amount of climate benefits, about 4 tons per acre per year in measurable natural climate solutions outcomes, if you will. And then I would like to highlight the efforts in the California Delta, and that land is wetlands that has very carbon-rich peat soils. And there we're working with scientists and others to demonstrate how restoration of the wetlands can generate significant benefits to the atmosphere while also creating habitat for wildlife and protecting the local community from increased flood risk and saltwater intrusion, both of which will be amplified by climate change.
Still, personally, I doubt we can take out enough food, enough fiber for 9 to 12 billion projected humans, all of whom want a modern, full-scale life. Won't those needs overwhelm the efforts to employ nature as a kind of carbon control?
Well, in the paper, we're ensuring that we maintain the current food supply. And then looking to the future, we are working with partners and ranchers in many places, including Brazil and in Indonesia, for what we call supply chain strategies. We're working to help create more food on the same number of acres to remove the incentive to change land management.
Lewis, prior to this paper, what did experts say was the maximum potential of natural climate solutions? And then what did your new team discover?
Well, our paper discovered that the potential is about 30% more than was previously forecasted in the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. And this is because, in part, that we looked at more pathways. We looked at more opportunities. So we know that avoided deforestation was one that people have looked at for many years. But we also looked at, well, what would happen if you actually avoided forest conversion or reforestation, or if you planted trees in the croplands. So we looked at more options here, more opportunities, and that gave us a greater percentage outcome, if you will, 30% more.
We recently had a Russian scientist on the show suggesting that enhancing natural biology could sequester enough carbon to allow us to continue burning fossil fuels. What do you think?
I don't agree with that. I think we need to continue to reduce emissions from the energy sector and from the transportation sector, where we've made progress. But the issue here with this paper is that natural climate solutions are not getting the same kind of attention that the energy and the transportation sectors are. We will not meet our climate goals if we don't address how our lands are managed. And what the paper shows us, and what we're learning here in California on a similar paper that we're working on, is that we can get really large, meaningful reductions, greenhouse gas reductions, from changes in how we manage our lands.
You know, I remember just 4 years ago, all I heard about was carbon capture and storage, and governments and think tanks were actually proposing that we build great big pipelines that would capture the slurry and pump it down into old wells, and it was a huge industrial solution. And now, instead, I'm hearing a lot of what you're talking about, that the forests and the natural lands could help us a lot more than that.
Well, carbon capture and storage is an idea. It's a experiment, if you will. What natural climate solutions offer is really the low-hanging fruit. Natural climate solutions are quick. We can do this now while we work on other technologies for the future. Natural climate solutions are also cost-effective. We found that a third of the reductions that we're talking about are available at less than $10 a ton. They're cheap right now. They're quick, they're cheap, and they provide a whole suite of other benefits that we've talked about, including biodiversity and food, as well as clean water for people all over the world.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I am Alex Smith. My guest is Lewis Bloomberg from the Nature Conservancy in California. We're talking about published new science showing natural climate solutions. Do you think there is a path to staying under 2 degrees C without a massive new stewardship of nature?
No.
But yet, I'm uncomfortable that humans need to run nature to survive. I mean, we have a tendency to build roads, to take the resources and overwhelm indigenous cultures as we try to help. Other people have suggested, well, we should just stay away, leave the land untouched. How does the team of scholars address that tough issue?
Well, Alex, the human activities have impacted every acre of the planet. You can go into the wilderness areas high in the mountains. You can go to the Arctic areas. You can go to the savannas of Australia, where the fire regime has been disrupted. So, you know, a hands-off policy is not going to make the changes that are necessary in greenhouse gas emissions in order to keep the planet habitable for the future.
And I notice in your bio that you were once the Deputy Director of External Affairs for the California Department of Forestry and Fire Protection. What do you make of the recent deadly wildfires in California, where we have a lot of stations, and do you see them as a definite climate signal?
Well, I think the fires in Northern California are a major tragedy. Over 40 people have died. There have been 5,000 homes and other structures destroyed. The fires are still burning, and we've had fires ignite in the last week in other parts of the state. So wildfire is a terrible tragedy here. It is one of many extreme events, and this is just what the scientists have predicted. We do know that climate change creates the conditions that will make extreme events more frequent and more severe. And that's just what we've seen in California. The analysis that's been done by the state of California, analysis that the Nature Conservancy worked to help support and fund, shows that the temperature has risen 1.8 degrees in Fahrenheit, the average land temperature in the state, as well as we just came out of a four-year drought. So we are seeing drier, hotter temperatures and conditions around the state, which lead to these larger fires, and that's just what's happening.
What does this new paper in PNAS add to the climate toolbox that maybe we didn't have before?
First of all, it really reinforces and clarifies the essential role that natural climate solutions play in addressing climate change. We will not succeed in meeting the ambitious reduction targets that we need to keep temperature below 2 degrees centigrade if we do not change how we manage our lands. So the paper reinforces strongly the reality and the imperative that we have to change how we manage our lands if we're going to achieve our climate goals. It also provides a menu of strategies that are available to all kinds of people, to landowners, to government officials, to NGOs, to people that really want to take this issue seriously and look at our land sector. So we've got a menu here of 20 different strategies, and you can pick and choose for what works in your area. And we also show here in the paper the connection between proper land management and protecting our water, our soil, our biodiversity, and our air quality.
Is there anything else you would like to talk about?
Well, I think that it's important that, for me at least, I draw some hope from the paper. You know, we can do this. It's not going to be easy, you know, and we need to get all hands on deck, and we need to be moving quickly. But here with the paper and with the work of the Nature Conservancy, we are hopeful because we do see an important and often overlooked pathway here, which is using natural climate solutions to aggressively fight climate change.
Our guest is Lewis Bloomberg. He is well known in conservation circles even before he became the director of the California Climate Change Program in that state's chapter of the Nature Conservancy. We've been talking about the new paper in PNAS titled Natural Climate Solutions. Find links to all this in my weekly show blog, published Wednesdays at ecoshock.org. You can find your nearest chapter of the Conservancy at www.nature.org. Lewis, thank you for telling us a little bit of better news.
Thank you, Alex. It was a pleasure talking with you today.
We are, as always, out of time for this week in Radio EcoShock. Thank you so much for listening, and please join us again.